Me and my friend of Cohen. Cohen, assistant chaplain. Chaplain, high American official. And nothing was said about the visa. The idea was I just make friends and mention it afterwards. And I remember Umansky, the conversation is, I remember. I said to Umansky, why do you...
In Russian?
Yeah. Everyone talked English. Umansky was an NKVD agent. He was quite high up in his day. Later became ambassador to Mexico, was killed in the air crash. Whether deliberate or not, you can tell. And I said to him, why did you invade Finland? No, not for Finland. Why did you take, why did you annex the Baltic states? By this time it happened, obviously. And he said, oh, that's quite easy to answer. New deal for Latvia, new deal for Estonia, new deal for Lithuania. You will understand, he said, said Chapman and Ben Cohen. New deal, these countries are under dictators. Naturally, we want democracy. At that point, fish was brought in. And he said, this is a very rare fish. My government knows that I'm a great gourmet. It comes from the Black Sea. It's quite difficult. It comes in special tins and wrapped in a very special paper. So it preserves its freshness. At that point, the butler, with long black whiskers, was the Tsarist butler, said, wait a minute, it is bass. That embarrassed him. Yeah. After this song and dance.
Yeah.
After we chatted about this and that, and I left. And then I went back to the embassy, and I thought, well, not sure about this journey. Does the Foreign Office really want me to go on? Because I had nothing, the embassy got no instructions. Yeah. What to do about me, or to put me on a plane for California, or anything. I had some money, I was given by Burgess, $200 or something. So I made the embassy. I knew two people there very well. One at Foster, the other man called Tony Rumbold,
yes.
Sir Anthony Rumbold Bart. Who was the second secretary?
Yeah.
My new photographer, who was a friend. He said, would you find out the Foreign Office? What do they, I mean, do they, what do they want me to do? What, when, go when and how, and what do they arrange it? Do they pay for these? You have to have them, I'm rather hung up. And they sent a telegram, and the answer was, it is not desired to employ Mr. Berlin in this or any other capacity. He is free to stay in the United States or do anything else he wishes. That is a telegram from Fitzroy McLean, after he became a friend, head of the, not the head, number two in the Northern Department, which had never been told about this.
The Northern Department of the Foreign Office.
Foreign Office, yes.
In other words, the refusal comes from the Foreign Office, not from Cripps directly.
Nothing to do with Cripps, no. And then there was a, when I got back to England, as a matter of fact, Cripps did send us a message saying, we don't want Latvians here.
Did he?
Yes.
Gracious.
You see, I met Cripps afterwards, I didn't text him with it. But something like that. And all we don't hear is, we go, no, compromising. Some of us have said that to him in the embassy.
Yes.
He only knew I was coming because of, unfortunately, because of Niebuhr.
Oh, I see.
Warm letter of Niebuhr, saying I was a wonderful man. In Moscow. But he didn't protest, he didn't, they didn't ask him. I mean, they were already prepared to sack me on the spot because they hadn't sent me, they didn't know anything about it. The whole thing was mysterious. There is, in fact, a file in the Foreign Office saying Mr. Berlin's mission, which somebody interrupted at some point, it had been gone. Somebody in the intelligence, a man called Sweet Huskett, when you were at Oxford, a nice man who worked in the intelligence, said he came across it. Somebody wondered what my mission was. There were a few details about 19 something, and he said suddenly in 1940, came to no further documents. What is it about? Anyhow, so then I thought, what should I do? Better go home. I was placed in what's called fourth position.
Yes.
Then,
but weren't you astonished that someone like Gladwin Jebb hadn't sorted this out? It does seem incredible to me that you would have to go all the way across the Atlantic to learn that Fitzmaurice Maclean of the Northern Department, the Foreign Office, back in London, hadn't even heard of it.
Not only Fitzmaurice Maclean, the head of it, who was a man called College of Sergeant or somebody, he was number two.
All right.
And had met him already. Before that, in Oxford, he was to come and see Clarissa, now even, as one of her superiors. But they didn't like him, didn't like me very much then. And it was he who stopped me. But I didn't know what could have gone on. Without Burgess, probably had no sense. It was all a plot. And then, no, I didn't think that surprised me. It was all done in a very sort of quick, wartime fashion. Given the Harold Nicholson, which was clear about appointing me.
Yes.
The Foreign Office didn't want to stand in the way.
Yeah.
I remember ringing up Roger Makins.
They did stand in the way.
Roger Makins,
yes,
whom I knew from All Souls, who was in the Foreign Office,
yeah,
saying that my situation had been sent there. Do you think Foreign Office would like that? He said, oh well, if Gladwin says it's all right, if I come across anything, I'll give it a push. Didn't have to. Anyhow, I was nervous. I didn't know that something was odd. Clearly I did. Then I began to be offered jobs in British jobs in Washington. I could see what it was. By this time we reached mid-August. Battle of Britain. They thought, hey, the Germans might win, they might invade Britain. In which case, if I was there, I'd be caught and tortured and killed, I must be saved. Not a word was said about this. It occurred to me that was the secret agenda.
Really?
I was touched, but nobody said it, as I began to be offered both. Would I like to be number three in the press department, in the ambassador, Mr. Childs, was in my boat going out. Would I like to do this or that? I could see that I'd been saved.
Yes.
But I was embarrassed about this.
Yes.
I thought I couldn't stay. It was too, either I made something in Oxford and Moscow, nothing in Washington. That's because I was there by accident. People did do that, and they caught, but I didn't think I could.
Yeah.
That'd be too, I don't know why, it's like Caesar's wife feelings I had.
It also was a miserable time for you. The letters from the Shoreham Hotel in New York in late August are not happy letters at all.
Did I go? No, I didn't go to the Shoreham Hotel in Washington, no.
No, in New York.
Oh, New York, yes.
That's what I mean.
Oh, yes.
Those letters from the Shoreham Hotel in New York are not happy letters.
No, they're not. I felt in a false position. So what happened then was that finally I thought, well, would you just do one job for us? What? Would you look through all the dispatches of the Associated Press to see whether they are anti-British, as we think they are, and defeat us, and generally if anyone not in our interest. I said, where do I do this? We do this in New York, in the British Library of Information, under Michael Angus Fletcher. And how long would that take? I said, it might take 2 or 3 weeks. Hundreds of them. Not only from England, but from France, Germany, wherever the EP was. Would you? I'm going short-handed. I could see there's still a way of saving me. I said, all right, this job I'll do.
Mm-hmm.
Provided I can go to England after that. They didn't say anything. I went up to New York. I was there the whole of the second part of August and September.
Yes.
And I did do the job. They did report that they were unfriendly. That's what they wanted to know. And that did make a difference.
Yes. It did make a difference.
To the Associated Press.
Yes.
There was a man, particularly in Germany, who was putting out the dispatches of a steam kind, called Louis Lochner. And there were English ones that said, the English are huddling in the shelters. I mean, the country's come, and there's no possibility of victory.
Yes.
They're all nation is terrified. It's not true. But I mean, they were very extremely defeatist,
yes,
and panic-stricken letters, all except one, who was one. The worst of them, I regret to tell you, but I never told him that, was the great, great New York Times, I forget whom you would have heard, you might indeed know, called Scotty Reston.
Oh, really?
Who was English, or Scotch. And that he was in London. For somebody must have been the AP then, and even produced some ghastly things. Not very Nazi, but
defeated.
Defeated, yes. Nazi. And the only man who was all right was that excellent man on the radio. You know what I mean? Oh dear.
Marek.
Very stout. Even then. Yeah. We have a good character.
Yeah.
Well then.
So you do those things through September and October?
Not October.
No, September.
Early in October, I got into the Yankee Clipper. Flew from New York to Lisbon. Seaplane. With Lord Lothian. Was going home.
Yeah.
We.
Did you have conversations with Lord Lothian?
Certainly. Well, we couldn't avoid it. We stopped in Horta, in the Azores, took a walk for 6 hours. He said, very charming, I mean, beautiful island, extremely wild. He said, very unlike Broadway, isn't it? That kind of thing. And we talked about the way, but nothing in particular. It was very good company. He hardly knew where he was, I think. And all the telegrams about me were from him. And then we went to Lisbon. He went straight to England.
Yeah.
I couldn't get on the plane, and I went to the Hotel Estoril in Lisbon. I went to the British Embassy and said, can I please be sent to England? I'm in a rather dubious position, but I do want to get home.
Yes.
Well, they didn't know what to do with me, but apparently I sufficiently impressed them for to put me on a plane. So about 4 days later, I had to wait all nervously. I was put in a plane, went to Bristol. There was an air raid going on. We arrived. I was delighted, I thought. So I'd come for. I felt better.
Yes. You
know, I'm always subject to guilt.
Yeah.
And I felt, well, it's rather like somebody, yes, somebody might ask me afterwards, I didn't feel it then, I felt it later. Sorry, just a moment. No, not then. I just enjoyed the area. Then I took a train from Bristol to Oxford, came back, went back to New College, was living, started life again, as if nothing.
That happened, began teaching.
Yes. Nobody asked what I was doing in the summer.
Yes.
Long vacation was over. Nobody asked any questions.
Yes.
I began teaching.
And how soon did you resume contact with Burgess?
Not then, but I think maybe in October.
Yes.
Late, I don't know. I can't tell you. They were crazy. I remember there was this lunch with Harold. I think it was then or later.
Did you ask Burgess to explain why he'd been called back?
No. No, nobody had told me. No, I didn't probe.
Yeah.
I didn't say, what actually happened. Anyhow, it was suddenly sacked from intelligence. I think Victor Oster, his great friend, must have said he wasn't very reliable. He must have had some certificate to say that he wasn't dependable. Nothing was wrong, he wasn't accused of anything. But he must have got some kind of unfriendly testimonial doubting his utility.
And possibly from Victor Rothschild.
That's what I suspected, but I never knew. Was I himself by then? Then, about November, late November, I received a letter from the Ministry of Information saying, dear Mr. Berlin, you appear to us to be overstaying your leave. Would you kindly explain what you're doing? I wrote back to the American Department and said, so far as I knew, I wasn't employed by the Ministry of Information, indeed anybody else. Therefore, I didn't think I could have leave. What does this mean? They said, oh, well, yes, I see. I think there's been some confusion. Perhaps you'll come visit us. So I went to London, quite happily, to the Ministry of Information, saw, and then I can't remember, some journalist, drunken journalist, was here to the American one. He said, look, you've been appointed to the British Information Services, New York. When? Oh, 3 weeks ago. But you failed to tell me. I'm afraid I think we did. Now, why was I appointed? Because during my AP days, I met two people who took to me. One was a man called Aubrey Morgan, who was a Welshman, married to Dwight Morris' daughter, brother-in-law of Lindbergh.
Yes.
And the other was called we'll have been it. And they were working in the British Library of Information. Oh. It had been turned from being a sort of British Library of Information into a propaganda bureau of sorts.
Yes.
And they talked to me, they liked me quite, thought it might be useful, and recommended to the Ministry of Information that I be appointed. What does it have back? Is it sweet? Nothing was said to me.
Right.
So then I then began to negotiate when to go and what to do. And I was then told in my class, the idea was to get America into the war, really, to influence the press and the radio media in the British direction.
Yeah.
That's all it really was.
Yeah.
But
this is November 40.
November 40. And I was then went off in January 41.
Right.
And...
Okay, let's... I want to pursue a different hair, which is to keep pursuing your connections with Burgess.
I didn't see him during that period. Maybe I'd lunch with him, but I didn't keep up.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see him in any systematic way.
Yes. And you didn't see him in Washington or New York during the war at all? He was never there?
He was never there.
No. He was in the...
He came back much later.
Yes.
He came to Washington in 14... I can't go on to you. And Burgess and me, all right.
Yes.
No, I did certainly meet him. I suppose when I was back on leave, 42-44, I can't promise you either I did or didn't. I have no recollection of it.
Mm.
I knew he was in the BBC, where Harold put him, and I don't think I saw him then. So I don't think I saw him in 42.
Mm-hmm.
He was then transferred to the Foreign Office, News Department. And I think I saw him then. 44, I think I must have seen him. But now they just talk to like that. And then I saw him much more after the war, when he was in properly established in the Foreign Office. It was all done by Hector McNeil, who he worked. I was very impressed by him. And then he was in the Far Eastern Department. And when the Chinese thing began, which was about when? 47, must be. He became terribly excited. Even that didn't indicate to me he was a communist.
I mean, how did you see him after the war? When
he was quite not. He rang up and said, do let them lunch again. I saw him once, 6 months. I mean, in the ordinary way.
In the same way as before, and he would come up to all sorts.
No. Only in London.
Only in London.
Yeah, no.
You meet him in a club or something?
How do you see? That was his club.
Yeah.
You invite me and Garanwe, or me and Sheila Grand Duff and Garanwe, or me and somebody else. You see?
Yeah.
I knew him as a Foreign Office official. And then I met him in the Reform Club, which I became a member after the war, and Blunt also, who I'd known before. That's another story.
Yeah.
And I used to talk to him about Zionism. They're both ferociously against.
Why did you talk to them about Zionism?
Because I was interested at that time.
Yes.
I'd just been to Israel, Palestine in 46.
Yes.
47. 47 I went. I came back and I was staying with Weizmann and all that. And I began talking to them about all that. And they were bitterly anti-Zionist, both of them. Again, I could have deduced from that.
Yes.
The party line.
But anti-Zionist on political grounds rather than on...
Well, they didn't quite say monstrous. I mean Arabs. The usual. And anti-Zionist against anti-Zionist. They didn't need to be. All anti-Zionist against the political. They were all political.
Yes.
But what could they be?
Yes.
They weren't anti-Semitic.
Yes.
But I did
and have... And
I roused them about that.
And you remember Blunt and Burgess together?
Together.
At the Reform Club.
At the Reform Club.
Talking about Zionism.
Talking about Zionism to me.
In
47. Yes. For example, 48. I don't know. That sort of period. And I remember conflict with them. Quite sharp encounters.
Did you have a sense that Blunt and Burgess were together as a couple?
No. They weren't a couple.
Yeah.
In that sense, they were great friends. I knew them long before.
Yes.
Burgess converted Blunt to communism.
Yes.
I think, but that I didn't know. But they were great friends before the war was perfectly known to everyone.
Yes.
And then I met Blunt independently.
Yes. remember your further contacts with Burgess, sort of 47 through 55.
Yes. I must have met him now and then, in a boredly social way, with no suspicion of anything particularly. He talked a lot about jokes about Bevin, is all I remember. He worked in the private office.
Okay.
Bevin and Director McNeil came together to the political office, in the foreign office.
What jokes did he make about Bevin?
He said, the wine he likes is called Newt St. George, I think. Newt St. George. There is that wine, isn't there?
Yeah.
Newt St. George. That's wine I like. And I remember Stuart at that time, too. Hampshire said to me how awful Bevin was.
Really?
And I met Bevin in Moscow. That's another story. And he used to tell a little story about the Foreign Office, but he was like any other Foreign Office official, as far as I was concerned. And sort of dear friend, I didn't know. I had nothing against him. I saw him quite casually.
Yes.
And then, it was Gorano, I'm sure. His best friend that time. The last meeting, that meeting in London, I have no recollection of. They must have been perfectly conventional. And nothing ever said or which I won't remember. Just rather amusing old friend when I saw him that way. But then there was a time when David Cecil in New College gave a party in honor of a very nice woman called Phyllis Young, who was a wife of a man called A.Z. Young, the little salon in Oxford. And she was going to London. And they gave a farewell party for her, to which he invited Bronwyn, who was both girls at the birth. And he brought Guy, as we might. And I met Guy, New College, common room party. And he said to me then, I'm being posted to Washington. And I said, but look, it'll be safe for you to go. I never knew what comedy is. After all, with your sexual addictions. McCarthy is very violent to have sex.
Well, you said that to him.
Yes. Well, it's notorious. People talk about bedfellow travellers. That's the joke. Are you safe? Should you go? No, well, I didn't. I've been appointed. Quite an interesting place. Of course, I said, you hate Americans. Well, I don't like them very much. This person's work to be done. And the moment, I said, they've sent me, they've appointed me. I mean, I am a member of the Foreign Office. I have to go where they tell me. That kind of line. And I thought, he will get into trouble. He will get into trouble. I must tell somebody. I must tell Roger Makins, who was then, at that time, high official Foreign Office. Then I said, I can't. Let the cachet. The right people write those backs. And say, beware. No, so I didn't. I did nothing at all. Then he went off to Washington. The rest you know.
Yes.
He got himself arrested by police, speeding, in order. He returned to London.
Yes.
Because of McLean.
Yes. And when did you first, you found out in the papers, as it were, or did you?
Darling. I met McLean in Washington. That's a long story, too.
You met McLean in Washington during the war?
In the embassy.
Yeah. And then again in Moscow in 45.
No,
yeah, I'm wrong, yes. It's in Washington that the famous scene occurs where McLean gets...
That's right. He says...
drunk. And
yes.
You tell a story about Alice Roosevelt Longworth.
Yeah, because, in fact, I knew her.
Yes.
How can you know a woman like that?
Yes.
The violent scene.
Yes.
He's drunk, very truculent.
And he actually shook your lapels.
No, that's the story told by Mr. Somebody in the years.
Not true. He simply shouted.
He shouted, yes. And also, it's not true that Douglas Fairbanks
was there.
Yeah.
Who was there?
Because I better begin in the beginning.
Yes. Yes.
Have I told him my relations with McLean?
No, you better tell me about McLean.
I never thought about it again.
Yes.
After 51.
After 51, that part that's of when the he, new college.
That's when he, no, no. No, part of new college was put in, well, before that. Yeah. 51 is when he went to Moscow.
Yes, sorry.
No, I didn't in fact see him after the point of police in Washington. Mm-hmm. In the opportunity.
Yes.
I didn't hear that. 51 is a total surprise to me.
Yes.
Equally McLean, equally everything.
What about McLean?
My friend Dr. Katkov must have worked a bit the intelligence of in a white Russian. Saw quite a lot of birches. Mm-hmm. In sort of the late '40s. Mm-hmm. And he saw quite a lot of people. He made himself extremely agreeable to a large circle of persons. Some didn't like him ever.
But McLean was a different kettle of fish altogether.
Well, McLean was a proper public school, sort of foreign office official, great friend of my friend Rumbold, married to an American lady called Melinda, and him I met in 1944. When he was posted to Washington. He came to see me in my little room. He said, my name is Donald McLean. We know a lot of the same people. We know, you know, the Bonham Carters. We know this. We know Sinclair. We know Cressida. What not? I don't know, Ridley. We ought to have met before. We have a lot of good friends in common. I think we ought to be friends. I said, I need to please. He was very good looking, extremely agreeable, very amusing. Not together, John. Well, we made friends, sort of. I mean, I don't know. We used to see each other in the corridors in the embassy, and I made a little meal or two with him. Then one day, he said to me, "You know, I work with people in the Pentagon and the State Department." He was the Tom Gensler, you see. And they're very pompous. People in the State Department are awful. Pentagon's pretty awful. And I hear that you know some new dealers. Do you? I say, yes, I do. Could I meet them? Seemed natural to me. Man of liberal convictions.
Yes.
Such a person I would know in England. So I said, all right, I'll try to. So then I rang up a lady who is identified from the Devaltitude II, to whom I said, there's a very charming, good-looking, and agreeable man called Donald McLean. Do you think you could ask him? He doesn't know many people. Do you think you could ask him dinner? I'm sure you'll like him very much. And then she said, yes, all right. And that was, she was then living in number 107th Street, somewhere in New Washington, far away. That's the present Mrs. Graham.
Gray.
What?
Gray.
Was then the sort of war widow. Her husband was in the Pacific. And he didn't want her to live in our father's palace, which is Maya,
yes.
Was our father.
Yes.
He had to live with a GI's wife. It was all very ideological, because
yes.
They were left-wing, that period. And she said, all right. And so she invited McLean and his wife, me, my friend Edward Pritchard, who was my best friend in Washington, and a couple called the Binghams. He was been a member of Congress for years, son of an American ambassador in London. New dealish, with a perfectly new wife. I mean, now they are no there. Just quite nice liberal people. Well, we all turned up. We had dinner. Dinner was all right. And then there was a dispute about whether Gone with the Wind was worth reading. And Mrs. Bingham said she thought it was. She began reading it. And McLean said it's absolute rubbish. Kitchen rubbish. There was some dispute about that, so I didn't take part in it. I could see his little shop. Then we moved into the other room for coffee. And then, do we have to go? No, coffee. And then I could see that McLean was drunk.
You'll make it on our behalf.
On my behalf, yes.
Tea for me, please. Thank you.
And then he suddenly said, The trouble about you is you see people like Mrs. Longworth. She's a horrible woman with horrible views. I don't say that you shouldn't see her if you want to see her. What I say is to have the kind of taste which makes it possible for you to want to see her is what I think is terrible about you. You really stand on that. So I said, you're taken aback, the real attack. He said, I don't say that in the 12th hour you won't be on our side, but not until then. You run as the hare, hunt with the hounds. Which is true, to a certain degree. And then?
But let me back you up. I missed something. What is the context in which he says that?
None. Out of the blue.
Out of the blue, where? Where does he say
that? Yeah, well, we're drinking coffee or whatever.
At Kenny Graham's.
Yes, yes.
Yes.
I'm drawing them.
Yes.
Sitting opposite him, suddenly.
Yes.
Suddenly attacked me.
Yes.
Apropos of nothing.
Had he been drinking?
Heavily. I'd never seen him drunk before. I knew he was drunk. And I said, well, you say that, but we were supposed to be fighting for civilization against barbarism. Civilization means that you're free to know anyone you wish. Of course, you must be judged by your friends. That I concede. But, and you must be prepared to shoot them in war, it is war or revolution, even if they are your friends. But until then, you are allowed to know them, even if people condemn you, because they don't like those sort of people. Silence. And he said, no, I disagree. Life is a battle. We ought to know which side we're on. And we ought to know and be on our side and not have dealings with the other side. That's my view. Everybody in the room agreed with this.
With him?
Yeah.
Not with you?
Totally with him.
Kay Graham included?
With everybody. So then I felt I was rather like Douglas Fairbanks on a table. There's a building of people with rapier. That's what I said to Boyle. That's how Fairbanks came into the story. Douglas Fairbanks, the old one was dead. Therefore,
yes, yes.
There must be this one. Oh. There are two stories I'm telling you.
Yes.
I remember making a joke. Thanks for Fairbanks. Yeah, that's... As you know, I'm rather indistinct in some ways when I talk. And then they all attacked me and said, there's nothing wrong with them doing. I don't know which side one was, your deal. Roosevelt couldn't know horrible people.
Well,
of course, Alice Longworth was an intimate friend of Kay's parents. Mm-hmm. And I met her the first time at her father's table with Kay.
That is to say, you met Alice Roosevelt Longworth
at yes.
Eugene Meyer's
dinner.
Table.
Yes. Kay was present.
Uh-huh.
Didn't appear to his as I knew fashion.
But and Kay in this discussion appears to take Donald MacLean's
side.
Don't
they all did. They all agreed.
Against and Alice Roosevelt Longworth.
Why didn't they? She was no longer part of the story.
Yes.
The story was life is a battle. We must know which side we're on and then have no relations with the enemy. That was it. From that alone, I could have deduced.
But didn't.
No. No. And even before that, I went to dinner with him with Dick Law. Richard Law was number two in the Foreign Office, and I sort of knew him. And he asked them both to dinner. I think he did atomic stuff too. And at some point, MacLean said, with a doctor, a Jewish doctor, who I brought along, I remember, and Law kept on saying, tell me, Doc. Well, he was Canadian, remember? And at a certain point, MacLean began talking about the standard of living in England and that sort of thing. And Law said, that's communist talk. That made no impression on me. I remember the
why case. Would he have said it was communist talk? What because is the flavor that. Of what MacLean is saying? I don't follow. I
can't remember what he did say, but it was something to do with working class and living. Something struck him as it.
Yes.
Wouldn't have struck me as it.
Yes.
There's all that sort of slightly jocose. As if you say to somebody in the Foreign Office. Then, after that, I went home rather wounded. Then they all rang up in the morning and said, hope you're not scarred, awful, we oughtn't have said that to you, hope you don't mind. A lot of peacemaking went on. I received a letter, McLean, saying one cannot keep one's friends if one behaves as I did last night.
You said you cannot keep
one cannot keep one's friends. If one behaves as I did last night, let him apologize. Would you come to lunch on Thursday? So I went to lunch on Thursday, and his wife was there, as his story is there. Isn't it? At a certain point, the name of Henry Wallace came up. He was then, I suppose, Vice President.
Yes. He's 44, he would be him.
Yes.
No! Yes, he's not. Isn't Truman Vice President?
No. 45. Well, this conversation may have occurred early in 44.
Yes.
Even late 43. I can't remember when McLean came. Around about then. Certainly he was Vice President then. He was replaced by Truman at some point. You were right.
In 44.
Well, it may have been, well, he was still there then. The conversation may have been spring 44.
Yeah.
Quite possible. And I said, well, I know people admire him. I think there's a screw loose somewhere, which I believe and still believe. I thought there was a screw loose. And we looked and didn't say anything. And looked, perhaps, but I thought that later. Let it be changed the subject. Then, when the women left the room, I said, you know, you shouldn't have said that at any Wallace. My wife and her sister admire him very much. So do I. I think he's a very good man. I think he does a great deal of good. And you shouldn't say things like that. It's simply wrong. Then I knew we're no longer friends.
Really?
After that, I never saw him again.
Really?
No.
Yes.
In no country, neither there nor in England. And he said quite disagreeable things about me. We were, in fact, on bad terms.
Yes.
But I realized he was sorry to have said it. But he meant it. And meant it even more after I turned out to be Auntie Wallace, who was a fellow traveller by that time.
Yes.
You see?
And you never talked to McLean again?
Never saw him in the
room. And he was transferred away from the embassy?
Never saw him in the room. I don't know when he was transferred. But I went before him, he went before me. I don't know. Our relations severed.
Yes.
And the general view was that Burgess was awful, McLean was charming. I took the opposite view. And, let me try and think. There was a senator's ex-widow whom I had first rather old, married old lady whom Mr. Peter Baltimore, he occupied a gigantic mansion called Evergreen. And I quarreled with her about something and McLean complained about me that making a bad name for England by being not very nice with the old lady. So, I mean, if my name is mentioned, you would say something unfriendly. So we went on having the same friends. We never met in a room again.
Let's stop here.
But I didn't know that he was a communist, didn't I?
Yes.
Philby I never met. But I knew there was something wrong because Burgess lived with him in Washington. I knew enough about Burgess to know he was very left-wing, loathed America. And he called him Kim. Was a very great friend.
Yes.
So I thought, well, when it all happened, I knew that Kim must be involved. Mm-hmm. Nobody else did.
So when Burgess went, you knew Philby must be involved.
Yes. In 51.
Yes.
And they absconded. People thought third man, fourth man, all the stuff. I never met Philby, I knew nothing. But I was sure there was never coming to the MCB. The intimacy was too great.
Did MI5 come and talk to you about all this?
Yes, very late, yeah, about 62 or 3.
Peter Wright.
Peter Wright.
Notorious Peter Wright.
Yeah.
Came and saw me in All Souls, and he said, may I talk to you? Would you tell me some things? I said, yes, certainly. I quite enjoyed it. I was interrogating. He wasn't an interrogator, so he must have done that off his own bat. He was a technician,
right.
Electrical technician.
Yeah. Australia.
That's all he was. Mm. But for some reason, he undertook to do it. And they even let him.
Yes.
He wasn't a professional interrogator into the government options. Mm. You're not surprised from the name. He then said.
Did he ask you about other people? Did he ask you about Jennifer Hart? Did he ask you about.
He asked me about the Burgess, who had just died. Mm. But then.
Yeah.
Nothing about Blunt, who had just been blown. They didn't know it.
Yes.
This is the year in which they found out about Blunt.
Yes.
But his name wasn't mentioned.
This is 62.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he gave me a list, not doing anything about the following.
And who was on that list?
Nobody I remember. Nobody I knew.
Not Stuart Hampshire, not Jennifer Hart, not the wrong way.
None of these people. No. Maybe one person, some American I knew. But yeah, nobody. And then he said, did you have any connection with Marxism? I said, what do you know? I read a book, Karl Marx. If you've read it, you'd realize Marxists wouldn't be terribly keen on me. He said, yes, I have read it, and I agree with you. and then we chatted away, I don't know. He must have asked you questions. But I talked quite freely. Then he saw me again in the Reform Club. At the Neum, maybe by that time. Maybe the Reform. Yes. 62, at the Neum. And he asked me more questions, same sort. I replied to it all quite truthfully. But he didn't compromise anybody because I don't think I knew any of the people he was talking about. McLean, yes. I didn't know all about that. Because by this time he was safely in Moscow. It was 10, 11 years after he absconded. Burgess died about then.
When did you learn?
Blunt, he asked about. He didn't. Not a word about that.
Let's stop there. There's more to ask you, but we'll have to go in a second.
Six. In both the Bowens. Young relatives, indeed.
Yes.
And because we were thrilling, well, yes. Rasmus, I was on. And then Dreiberg appeared at that party. How he appeared there, I don't know how he made his way. Not under my Soviet agency. That's where I saw Khrushchev the second time. And Politburo was there, except Molotov was in Caucasus. And he rather went up to me and he said, I tried to do it. He said, nothing wrong with the Soviet Union, except that I think the Soviet Union does a bit too much suppression of native languages. I think the local cultures could be supported. But apart from that, I found absolutely nothing to complain of. Really. And he then said, there's an old friend of ours living here, name of Burgess. I'm going to see him tonight. Would you like to come? Well, went through my head, shall I not? I thought, oh dear, I don't mind meeting him again, really. Communism doesn't disturb me. But I think it'd be too bad. Ian Forster, a great friend, was always telling me about personal relations being so important. He compromised Blunt. Poor man, who suffered. And other people whom he knew. You see, Goron was grilled, Blunt's career was, to some extent, damaged. No, I don't want to have a row with him. Beside which, I'm staying with Bolan, and I'm so happy to say, I'd have to report. I'd seen him. He'd be rather embarrassed for me to go to report. I think it was not worth it. So I said, no, I'd rather not. And I said, have we seen McLean too? I said, I don't see why you should ask that. There are plenty of Englishmen living in Malaga who don't necessarily know each other. There are just Englishmen living in Moscow. Why should they know each other? I remember that. He then said, there's one thing I would like you to do. I'm writing a book with Guy Burgess. It's going to be rather a surprise. Would you mind not telling anyone? Because it's quite important. You suddenly come out of the blue, I said, all right, I won't tell. He thought it just cowardice my part, not to see him. Maybe partly it was. You know, I didn't. What's the name? Went to see him, Randolph Churchill. And he said to Randolph, I'm still a communist, still a homosexual. The only thing about me is I love communists. I hate the Russians. Could I have a place? Something. Maybe I ought to have something more safe on the table.